This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Siege of Darkness, written by R.A. Salvatore, narrated by Victor Bavin. Prologue. By all appearances, she was too fair a creature to be walking through the swirling sludge of this smoky layer of the abyss. Too beautiful. Her features were sculpted fine and delicate, her shining ebony skin giving her the appearance of animated artwork, an obsidian sculpture come to life. The monstrous things around her, crawling slugs and bat-winged denizens, monitored her every move, watched her carefully, cautiously. Even the largest and strongest of them, gigantic fiends that could sack a fair-sized city, kept a safe distance, for appearances could be deceiving. While this fine-featured female seemed delicate, even frail by the standards of the gruesome monsters of the abyss, she could easily destroy any one, any 10, any 50 of the fiends now watching her. They knew it, too. And her passage was unhindered. She was Lolth, the Spider Queen, goddess of the Drow, the Dark Elves. She was chaos incarnate, an instrument of destruction, a monster beneath a delicate facade. Lolth calmly strolled into a region of tall, thick mushrooms, clustered on small islands amid the grimy swirl. She walked from island to island without concern, stepping so lightly about the slurping sludge that not even the bottoms of her delicate black slippers were soiled. She found many of this level's strongest inhabitants, even true Tanari fiends, sleeping amid those mushroom groves, and rudely roused them. Inevitably, the irritable creatures came awake snarling and promising eternal torture, and just as inevitably, they were much relieved when Lolth demanded of them only a single answer to a single question. "Where is he?" she asked each time. And though none of the monsters knew of the great fiend's exact location, their answers led Lolth on, guided her until at last she found the beast she was looking for, a huge bipedal Tanari, with a canine maw, the horns of a bull, and tremendous leathery wings folded behind its huge body. Looking quite bored, it sat in a chair it had carved from one of the mushrooms, its grotesque head resting on the upraised palm of one hand. Dirty, curved claws scratched rhythmically against its pallid cheek. In its other hand, the beast held a many-tongued whip, and every so often snapped it around, lashing at the side of the mushroom chair, where crouched the unfortunate lesser creature it had selected for torture during this point of eternity. The smaller denizen yelped and whined pitifully, and that drew another stinging crack of the merciless fiend's whip. The seated beast grunted suddenly, head coming up alert, red eyes peering intently into the smoky veil swirling all around the mushroom throne. Something was about, it knew, something powerful. Lolth walked into view, not slowing in the least as she regarded this monster, the greatest of this area. A guttural growl escaped the Tanari's lips, lips that curled into an evil smile, then turned down into a frown as it considered the pretty morsel walking into its lair. At first, the fiend thought Lolth a gift, a lost, wandering dark elf far from the material plane and her home. It didn't take the fiend long to recognize the truth of this one, though. It sat up straight in its chair. Then, with incredible speed and fluidity for one its size, it brought itself to its full height, 12 feet, and towered over the intruder.
"Sit, heir to,"
Lolth bade it, waving her hand impatiently.
"I have not come to destroy you."
A second growl issued from the proud Tanari, but Ertu made no move for Lolth, understanding that she could easily do what she had just claimed that she had not come here to do. just to salvage a bit of his pride, ere to remain standing.
"Sit!"
Lolth said suddenly, fiercely, and Ertu, before he registered the movement, found himself back on the mushroom throne. Frustrated, he took up his whip and battered the sniveling beast that groveled at his side.
"Why are you here, Drow?"
Ertu grumbled, his deep voice breaking into higher, crackling whines, like fingernails on slate.
"You have heard the rumblings of the Pantheon?"
Lolth asked. Ertu considered the question for a long moment. Of course he had heard that the gods of the realms were quarreling, stepping over each other in intrigue-laden power grabs and using intelligent lesser creatures as pawns in their private games. In the Abyss, this meant that the denizens, even greater Tanari such as Ertu, were often caught up in unwanted political intrigue. Which was exactly what Ertu figured and feared was happening here.
"A time of great strife is approaching,"
Lolth explained.
"A time when the gods will pay for their foolishness."
Ertu chuckled, a grating, terrible sound. Lolth's red glowing gaze fell over him scornfully.
"Why would such an event displease you, Lady of Chaos?"
the fiend asked.
"This trouble will be beyond me,"
Lolth explained, deadly serious.
"Beyond us all. I will enjoy watching the fools of the Pantheon jostled about, stripped of their false pride, some perhaps even slain. But any worshipped being who is not cautious will find herself caught in the trouble."
"Lolth was never known for caution,"
Ertu put in dryly.
"Lolth was never a fool,"
the Spider Queen quickly replied. Ertu nodded, but sat quietly for a moment on his mushroom throne, digesting it all.
"What has this to do with me?"
he asked finally. For Tanari were not worshipped, and thus Ertu did not draw his powers from the prayers of any faithful.
"Menzo Berenzon,"
Lolth replied, naming the fabled city of Drow, the largest base of her worshippers in all the realms. Ertu cocked his grotesque head.
"The city is in chaos already,"
Lolth explained.
"As you would have it,"
Ertu put in, and he snickered.
"As you have arranged it."
Lolth didn't refute that.
"But there is danger,"
the beautiful Drow went on.
"If I am caught in the troubles of the Pantheon, the prayers of my priestesses will go unanswered."
"Am I expected to answer them?"
Ertu asked incredulously.
"The faithful will need protection."
"I cannot go to Menzo Berenzon!"
Ertu roared suddenly, his outrage, the outrage of years of banishment, spilling over. Menzo Berenzon was a city of Faerun's Underdark, the great labyrinth beneath the world's surface. But though it was separated from the region of sunlight by miles of thick rock, it was still a place of the material plane. Years ago, Ertu had been on that plane at the call of a minor wizard and had stayed there in search of Crenshinabon, the crystal shard, a mighty artifact, relic of a past and greater age of sorcery. The great Tanari had been so close to the relic. He had entered the tower it had created in its image and had worked with its possessor, a pitiful human who would have died soon enough, leaving the fiend to his coveted treasure. But then Ertu had met a dark elf, a renegade from Lolth's own flock, from Menzo Berenzon, the city she now apparently wanted him to protect. Drizzt Do'Urden had defeated Ertu, and to a Tanari, a defeat on the material plane meant 100 years of banishment in the Abyss. Now Ertu trembled visibly with rage, and Lolth took a step backward, preparing herself in case the beast attacked before she could explain her offer.
You cannot go, she agreed. But your minions can. I will see that a gate is kept open, if all the priestesses of my domain must tend it continually.
Ertu's thunderous roar drowned out the words. Lolth understood the source of that agony. A fiend's greatest pleasure was to walk loose on the prime material plane, to challenge the weak souls and weaker bodies of the various races. Lolth understood, but she did not sympathize. Evil Lolth never sympathized with any creature.
I cannot deny you,
Ertu admitted, and his great bulbous bloodshot eyes narrowed wickedly. His statement was true enough. Lolth could enlist his aid simply by offering him his very existence in return. The Spider Queen was smarter than that, however. If she enslaved Ertu, and was indeed, as she expected, caught up in the coming storm, Ertu might escape her capture, or worse, find a way to strike back at her. Lolth was malicious and merciless in the extreme, but she was, above all else, intelligent. She had in her possession honey for this fly.
This is no threat, she said honestly to the fiend. This is an offer.
Ertu did not interrupt. Still, the bored and outraged fiend trembled on the edge of catastrophe.
I have a gift, Ertu,
she purred.
A gift that will allow you to end the banishment Drizdo Erden has placed on you.
The Tanari did not seem convinced.
No gift, he rumbled. No magic can break the terms of banishment. Only he who banished me can end the indenture.
Lolth nodded her agreement. Not even a goddess had the power to go against that rule.
But that is exactly the point,
the Spider Queen exclaimed.
This gift will make Drizdo Erden want you back on his plane of existence, back within his reach.
Ertu did not seem convinced. In response, Lolth lifted one arm and clamped her fist tightly, and a signal, a burst of multicolored sparks and a rocking blast of thunder shook the swirling sludge and momentarily stole the perpetual gray of the dismal level. Forlorn and beaten, head down, for it did not take one such as Lolth very long to sunder the pride, he walked from the fog. Ertu did not know him, but understood the significance of this gift. Lolth clamped her fist tight again. Another explosive signal sounded, and her captive fell back into the veil of smoke. Ertu eyed the Spider Queen suspiciously. The Tanari was more than a little interested, of course, but he realized that most everyone who had ever trusted the diabolical Lolth had paid greatly for their foolishness. Still, this bait was too great for Ertu to resist. His canine maw turned up into a grotesque, wicked smile.
Look upon Menzo Berenson, Lolth said,
and she waved her arm before the thick stalk of a nearby mushroom. The plant's fibers became glassy, reflecting the smoke, and a moment later Lolth and the fiend saw the city of Drow.
Your role in this will be small, I assure you,
Lolth said.
But vital. Do not fail me, great Ertu.
It was as much a threat as a plea, the fiend knew.
The gift?
He asked.
When things are put aright.
Again a suspicious look crossed Ertu's huge face.
Drizdo Erden is a pittance, Lolth said. Daemon and Ashesbernon, his family, is no more, so he means nothing to me. Still, it would please me to watch great and evil Ertu pay back the renegade for all the inconveniences he has caused.
Ertu was not stupid. Far from it. What Loth was saying made perfect sense, yet he could not ignore the fact that it was Loth, the Spider Queen, the Lady of Chaos, who was making these tempting offers. Neither could he ignore the fact that her gift promised him relief from the interminable boredom. He could beat 1,000 minor fiends a day, every day, torture them and send them crawling pitifully into the muck. But if he did that for 1,000,000 days, it would not equal the pleasure of 1 hour on the material plane, walking among the weak, tormenting those who did not deserve his vengeance. The great Tanari agreed. Part 1. Rumbles of Discord. I watched the preparations unfolding at Mithril Hall. Preparations for war. For, though we, especially Catti Bree, had dealt House Bayenri a stinging defeat back in Menzo Berenzon, none of us doubted that the Dark Elves might come our way once more. Above all else, Matron Bayenri was likely angry, and having spent my youth in Menzo Berenzon, I knew it was not a good thing to make an enemy of the First Matron Mother. Still, I liked what I was seeing here in the Dwarven Stronghold. Most of all, I enjoyed the spectacle of Brunner Battlehammer. Brunner! My dearest friend! The dwarf I had fought beside since my days in Icewind Dale, days that seemed very long ago indeed. I had feared Brunner's spirit forever broken when Wulfgar fell, that the fire that had guided this most stubborn of dwarves through seemingly insurmountable obstacles in his quest to reclaim his lost homeland had been forever doused. Not so, I learned in those days of preparation. Brunner's physical scars were deeper now. His left eye was lost, and a bluish line ran diagonally across his face, from forehead to jawbone. But the flames of spirit had been rekindled, burning bright behind his good eye. Brunner directed the preparations, from agreeing to the fortification designs being constructed in the lowest tunnels, to sending out emissaries to the neighboring settlements in search of allies. He asked for no help in the decision-making, and needed none. For this was Brunner, 8th King of Mithril Hall, a veteran of so many adventures, a dwarf who had earned his title. His grief was gone, and he was king again, to the joy of his friends and subjects. "Let the damned drow come!" Brunner growled quite often, and always he nodded in my direction if I was about, as if to remind me that he meant no personal insult. In truth, that determined war cry from Brunner Battlehammer was among the sweetest things I had ever heard. What was it, I wondered, that had brought the grieving dwarf from his despair? And it wasn't just Brunner. All around me I saw an excitement, in the dwarves, in Catti Bree, even in Regis, the halfling known more for preparing for lunch and nap than for war. I felt it too, that tingling anticipation, that camaraderie that had me and all the others patting each other on the back, offering praises for the simplest of additions to the common defense, and raising our voices together in cheer whenever good news was announced. What was it? It was more than shared fear. More than giving thanks for what we had while realizing that it might soon be stolen away. I didn't understand it then. In that time of frenzy, in that euphoria of frantic preparations. Now, looking back, it is an easy thing to recognize. It was hope. To any intelligent being, there is no emotion more important than hope. Individually or collectively, we must hope that the future will be better than the past, that our offspring and theirs after them will be a bit closer to an ideal society, whatever our perception of that might be. Certainly, a warrior barbarian's hope for the future might differ from the ideal fostered in the imagination of a peaceful farmer, and a dwarf would not strive to live in a world that resembled an elf's ideal. But the hope itself, is not so different. It is at those times when we feel we are contributing to that ultimate end, as it was in Mithril Hall when we believed the battle with Menzo Baranzon would soon come, that we would defeat the Dark Elves and end once and for all the threat from the Underdark City. We feel true elation. Hope is the key. The future will be better than the past or the present. Without this belief, there is only the self-indulgent, ultimately empty striving of the present, as in Drow society, or simple despair, the time of life wasted in waiting for death. Brunner had found a cause, we all had, and never have I been more alive than in those days of preparation in Mithril Hall. Drizzt Do'Urden. Chapter 1 Diplomacy. Her thick auburn hair bouncing below her shoulders, Catti Bree worked furiously to keep the drow swirling scimitars at bay. She was a solidly built woman, 130 pounds of muscles, finely toned from living her life with Brunner's dwarven clan. Catti Bree was no stranger to the forge or the sledge or the sword. And this new blade, its white metal pommel sculpted in the likeness of a unicorn's head, was by far the most balanced weapon she had ever swung. Still, Catti Bree was hard-pressed, indeed overmatched by her opponent this day. Few in the realms could match blades with Drizzt Do'Urden, the drow ranger. He was no larger than Catti Bree, a few pounds heavier perhaps with his tight-muscled frame. His white hair hung as low as Catti Bree's mane and was equally thick, and his ebony skin glistened with streaks of sweat, a testament to the young woman's prowess. Drizzt's two scimitars crossed in front of him, one of them glowing a fierce blue, even through the protective padding that covered it, then went back out wide, inviting Catti Bree to thrust straight between. She knew better than to make the attempt. Drizzt was too quick, and could strike her blade near its tip with one scimitar, while the other alternately parried low, batting the opposite way near the hilt. With a single step diagonally to the side, following his closer parrying blade, Drizzt would have her beaten. Catti Bree stepped back instead, and presented her sword in front of her. Her deep blue eyes peeked out around the blade, which had been thickened with heavy material, and she locked stares with the drow's lavender orbs. "An opportunity missed?" Drizzt teased. "A trap avoided," Catti Bree was quick to reply. Drizzt came ahead in a rush, his blades crossing, going wide and cutting across, one high and one low. Catti Bree dropped her left foot behind her and fell into a crouch, turning her sword to parry the low-rushing blade, dipping her head to avoid the high. She needn't have bothered, for the cross came too soon, before Drizzt's feet had caught up to the move, and both his scimitars swished through the air short of the mark. Catti Bree didn't miss the opening and darted ahead, sword thrusting. Back snapped Drizzt's blades, impossibly fast, slamming the sword on both its sides. But Drizzt's feet weren't positioned correctly for him to follow the move, to go diagonally ahead and take advantage of Catti Bree's turned sword. The young woman went ahead and to the side instead, sliding her weapon free of the clinch and executing the real attack, the slash at Drizzt's hip. Drizzt's backhand caught her short, drove her sword harmlessly high. They broke apart again, eyeing each other, Catti Bree wearing a sly smile. In all their months of training, she had never come so close to scoring a hit on the agile and skilled drow. Drizzt's expression stole her glory, though, and the drow dipped the tips of his scimitars toward the floor, shaking his head in frustration.
"The bracers?" Catti Bree asked,
referring to the magical wristbands, wide pieces of black material lined with gleaming mithril rings. Drizzt had taken them from Dantrag Beenri, the deposed weapons master of Menzo Baranzon's first house, after defeating Dantrag in mortal combat. Rumors said those marvelous bracers allowed Dantrag's hands to move incredibly fast, giving him the advantage in combat. Upon battling the lightning quick Bayenri, Drizzt had come to believe those rumors, and after wearing the bracers in sparring for the last few 10 days, he had confirmed their abilities. But Drizzt wasn't convinced that the bracers were a good thing. In the fight with Dantrag, he had turned Dantrag's supposed advantage against the drow, for the weapons master's hands moved too quickly for Dantrag to alter any started move, too quickly for Dantrag to improvise if his opponent made an unexpected turn. Now, in these sparring exercises, Drizzt was learning that the bracers held another disadvantage. His feet couldn't keep up with his hands. "You'll learn them," Caddybri assured. Drizzt wasn't so certain. "Fighting is an art of balance and movement," he explained.
"And faster ye are,"
Caddybri replied. Drizzt shook his head. "Faster are my hands," he said. "A warrior does not win with his hands. He wins with his feet, by positioning himself to best strike the openings in his opponent's defenses."
"The feet'll catch up," Caddybri replied. "Dantrag was the best men's Oberynzon had to offer, and ye said yourself that the bracers were the reason."
Drizzt couldn't disagree that the bracers greatly aided Dantrag, but he wondered how much they would benefit one of his skill, or one of Zacnaphane's, his father's skill. It could be, Drizzt realized, that the bracers would aid a lesser fighter, one who needed to depend on the sheer speed of his weapons. But the complete fighter, the master who had found harmony between all his muscles, would be put off balance. Or perhaps the bracers would aid someone wielding a heavier weapon, a mighty warhammer such as Aegis Fang. Drizzt scimitars, slender blades of no more than 2 pounds of metal, perfectly balanced by both workmanship and enchantment, weaved effortlessly, and even without the bracers his hands were quicker than his feet.
"Come on, then,"
Caddybri scolded, waving her sword in front of her, her wide blue eyes narrowing intently, her shapely hips swiveling as she fell into a low balance. She sensed her chance, Drizzt realized. She knew he was fighting at a disadvantage, and finally sensed her chance to pay back one of the many stinging hits he had given her in their sparring. Drizzt took a deep breath and lifted the blades. He owed it to Caddybri to oblige, but he meant to make her earn it. He came forward slowly, playing defensively. Her sword shot out, and he hit it twice before it ever got close, on its left side with his right hand, and on its left side again, bringing his left hand right over the presented blade and batting it down with a downward parry. Caddybri fell with the momentum of the double block, spinning a complete circle, rotating away from her adversary. When she came around, predictably, Drizzt was in close, scimitars weaving. Still, the patient drow measured his attack, did not come too fast and strong. His blades crossed and went out wide, teasing the young woman. Caddybri growled and threw her sword straight out again, determined to find that elusive hole. And in came the scimitars, striking in rapid succession, again both hitting the left side of Caddybri's sword. As before, Caddybri spun to the right, but this time Drizzt came in hard. Down went the young woman in a low crouch, her rear grazing the floor, and she skittered back. Both of Drizzt's blades swooshed through the air above and before her. For again, his cuts came before his feet could rightly respond and position him. Drizzt was amazed to find that Caddybri was no longer in front of him. He called the move the Ghost Step and had taught it to Caddybri only a 10 day earlier. The trick was to use the opponent's swinging weapon as an optical shield, to move within the vision-blocked area so perfectly and quickly that your opponent would not know you had come forward and to his side, that you had, in fact, stepped behind his leading hip. Reflexively, the drow snapped his leading scimitar straight back, blade pointed low, for Caddybri had gone past in a crouch. He beat the sword to the mark too quickly, and the momentum of his scimitar sent it sailing futilely in front of the coming attack. Drizzt winced as the unicorn-handled sword slapped hard against his hip. For Caddybri, the moment was one of pure delight. She knew, of course, that the bracers were hindering Drizzt, causing him to make mistakes of balance, mistakes that Drizzt Do'Urden hadn't made since his earliest days of fighting. But even with the uncomfortable bracers, the drow was a powerful adversary and could likely defeat most swordsmen. How delicious it was, then, when Catti Bree found her new sword slicing in unhindered. Her joy was stolen momentarily by an urge to sink the blade deeper, a sudden, inexplicable anger focused directly on Drizzt.
"Touch!" Drizzt called,
the signal that he had been hit. And when Catti Bree straightened and sorted out the scene, she found the drow standing a few feet away, rubbing his sore hip.
"Sorry,"
she apologized, realizing she had struck far too hard.
"Not to worry," Drizzt replied slyly. "Surely your one hit does not equal the combined pains my scimitars have caused you."
The dark elf's lips curled up into a mischievous smile.
"Or the pains I will surely inflict on you in return."
"Methinkings that I'm catching ye, Drizzt Do'Urden,"
Catti Bree answered calmly, confidently.
"You'll get your hits, but you'll take your hits as well."
They both laughed at that, and Catti Bree moved to the side of the room and began to remove her practice gear. Drizzt slid the padding from one of his scimitars and considered those last words. Catti Bree was indeed improving, he agreed. She had a warrior's heart, tempered by a poet's philosophy, a deadly combination indeed. Catti Bree, like Drizzt, would rather talk her way out of a battle than wage it. But when the avenues of diplomacy were exhausted, when the fight became a matter of survival, then the young woman would fight with conscience clear and passion heated. All her heart and all her skill would come to bear, and in Catti Bree, both of those ingredients were considerable. And she was barely into her 20s. In Menzo Baranzon, had she been a drow, she would be an Eric Tynalith now, the school of Loth, her strong morals being assaulted daily by the lies of the Spider Queen's priestesses. Drizzt shook that thought away. He didn't even want to think of Catti Bree in that awful place. Suppose she had gone to the drow school of fighters, Melee Magvir instead, he mused. How would she fare against the likes of young drow? Well, Drizzt decided, Catti Bree would be near the top of her class, certainly among the top 10 or 15%, and her passion and dedication would get her there. How much could she improve under his tutelage, Drizzt wondered, and his expression soured as he considered the limitations of Catti Bree's heritage. He was in his 60s, barely more than a child by drow standards, for they could live to see 7 centuries. But when Catti Bree reached his tender age, she would be old, too old to fight well. That notion pained Drizzt greatly. Unless the blade of an enemy or the claws of a monster shortened his life, he would watch Catti Bree grow old, would watch her pass from this life. Drizzt looked at her now as she removed the padded baldric and unclasped the metal collar guard. Under the padding above the waist, she wore only a simple shirt of light material. It was wet with perspiration now and clung to her. She was a warrior, Drizzt agreed. But she was also a beautiful young woman, shapely and strong, with a spirit of a foal first learning to run and a heart filled with passion. The sound of distant furnaces, the sudden, increased ringing of hammer on steel, should have alerted Drizzt that the room's door had opened, but it simply didn't register in the distracted drow's consciousness.
"Hey!"
came a roar from the side of the chamber, and Drizzt turned to see Brunner storm into the room. He half expected the dwarf, Catti Bree's adoptive, overprotective father, to demand what in the 9 hells Drizzt was looking at. And Drizzt's sigh was one of pure relief when Brunner, his fiery red beard foamed with spittle, instead took up a tirade about Settlestone, the barbarian settlement south of Mithril Hall. Still, the drow figured he was blushing, and hoped that his ebon-hued skin would hide it, as he shook his head, ran his fingers through his white hair to brush it back from his face, and likewise began to remove the practice gear. Catti Bree walked over, shaking her thick auburn mane to get the droplets out.
Berkthgar is being difficult, she reasoned, referring to Berkthgar the Bold, Settlestone's new chieftain. Brunner snorted.
Berkthgar can't be anything but difficult.
Drizzt looked up at beautiful Catti Bree. He didn't want to picture her growing old, though he knew she would do it with more grace than most.
He's a proud one, Catti Bree replied to her father, and afraid.
Bah! Brunner retorted. What's he got to be afraid of? Got a couple hundred strong men around him, and not an enemy in sight.
He is afraid he will not stand well against the shadow of his predecessor, Drizzt explained, and Catti Bree nodded. Brunner stopped in mid-bluster and considered the drow's words. Berkthgar was living in Wulfgar's shadow, in the shadow of the greatest hero the barbarian tribes of faraway Icewind Dale had ever known. The man who had killed Drakos Isingdeath, the White Dragon. The man who, at the tender age of 20, had united the fierce tribes and shown them a better way of living. Brunner didn't believe any human could shine through the spectacle of Wulfgar's shadow, and his resigned nod showed that he agreed with and ultimately accepted the truth of the reasoning. A great sadness edged his expression and rimmed his steel-gray eye as well, for Brunner could not think of Wulfgar, the human who had been a son to him, without that sadness. "On what point is he being difficult?" Drizzt asked, trying to push past the difficult moment.
"On the whole damned alliance," Brunner huffed.
Drizzt and Catti Bree exchanged curious expressions. It made no sense, of course. The barbarians of Settlestone and the dwarves of Mithril Hall already were allies, working hand in hand, with Brunner's people mining the precious mithril and shaping it into valuable artifacts, and the barbarians doing the bargaining with merchants from nearby towns, such as Nesme on the Trollmoors or Silvery Moon to the east. The two peoples, Brunner's and Wulfgar's, had fought together to clear Mithril Hall of evil gray dwarves, the Duergar, and the barbarians had come down from their homes in faraway Icewind Dale, resolved to stay, only because of this solid friendship and alliance with Brunner's clan. It made no sense that Berkthgar was being difficult, not with the prospect of a drow attack hanging over their heads.
"He wants the hammer,"
Brunner explained, recognizing Drizzt and Catti Bree's doubts. That explained everything. The hammer was Wulfgar's hammer, mighty Aegis Fang, which Brunner himself had forged as a gift for Wulfgar during the years the young man had been indentured to the red-bearded dwarf. During those years, Brunner, Drizzt, and Catti Bree had taught the fierce young barbarian a better way. Of course Berkthgar would want Aegis Fang, Drizzt realized. The warhammer had become more than a weapon, had become a symbol to the hearty men and women of Settlestone. Aegis Fang symbolized the memory of Wulfgar, and if Berkthgar could convince Brunner to let him wield it, his stature among his people would increase tenfold. It was perfectly logical, but Drizzt knew Berkthgar would never, ever convince Brunner to give him the hammer. The dwarf was looking at Catti Bree then, and Drizzt, in regarding her as well, wondered if she was thinking that giving the hammer to the new barbarian leader might be a good thing. How many emotions must be swirling in the young woman's thoughts, Drizzt knew. She and Wulfgar were to have been wed. They had grown into adulthood together and had learned many of life's lessons side by side. Could Catti Bree now get beyond that, beyond her own grief, and follow a logical course to seal the alliance?
No,
she said finally, resolutely.
The hammer he cannot have.
Drizzt nodded his agreement, and was glad that Catti Bree would not let go of her memories of Wulfgar, of her love for the man. He too had loved Wulfgar, as a brother, and he could not picture anyone else, neither Berkthgar nor the god Tempus himself, carrying Aegis Fang.
Never thought to give it to him,
Brunner agreed. He wagged an angry fist in the air, the muscles of his arm straining with the obvious tension.
But if that half-son of a reindeer asks again, I'll give him something else, don't ye doubt.
Drizzt saw a serious problem brewing. Berthgar wanted the hammer, that was understandable, even expected. But the young, ambitious barbarian leader apparently did not appreciate the depth of his request. This situation could get much worse than a strain on necessary allies, Drizzt knew. This could lead to open fighting between the peoples, for Drizzt did not doubt Brunner's claim for a moment. If Berthgar demanded the hammer as ransom for what he should give unconditionally, he'd be lucky to get back into the sunshine with his limbs attached.
"Me and Drizzt'll go to Settlestone," Catti Bree offered.
"We'll get Berthgar's word and give him nothing in return."
"The boy's a fool,"
Brunner huffed.
"But his people are not foolish," Catti Bree added. "He's wanting the hammer to make himself more the leader. We'll teach him that asking for something he cannot have will make him less the leader."
Strong and passionate, and so wise, Drizzt mused, watching the young woman. She would indeed accomplish what she had claimed. He and Catti Bree would go to Settlestone and return with everything Catti Bree had just promised her father. The drow blew a long, low sigh as Brunner and Catti Bree moved off, the young woman going to retrieve her belongings from the side of the room. He watched the renewed hop in Brunner's step, the life returned to the fiery dwarf. How many years would King Brunner Battlehammer rule? Drizzt wondered. 100? 200? Unless the blade of an enemy or the claws of a monster shortened his life, the dwarf, too, would watch Catti Bree grow old and pass away. It was an image that Drizzt, watching the light step of this spirited young foal, could not bear to entertain. Kazid Hea, or Cutter, rested patiently on Catti Bree's hip, its moment of anger past. The sentient sword was pleased by the young woman's progress as a fighter. She was able, no doubt, but still, Kazid Hea wanted more, wanted to be wielded by the very finest warrior. Right now, that warrior seemed to be Drizzt O'Erden. The sword had gone after Drizzt when the drow renegade had killed its former wielder, Dantrag Beenri. Kazid Hea had altered its pommel, as it usually did, from the sculpted head of a fiend, which had lured Dantrag, to one of a unicorn, knowing that was the symbol of Drizzt O'Erden's goddess. Still, the drow ranger had bade Catti Bree take the sword, for he favored the scimitar. Favored the scimitar. How Kazid Hea wished that it might alter its blade as it could its pommel, if the weapon could curve its blade, shorten and thicken it. But Kazid Hea could not, and Drizzt would not wield a sword. The woman was good, though, and getting better. She was human, and would not likely live long enough to attain as great a proficiency as Drizzt, but if the sword could compel her to slay the drow, there were many ways to become the best. Matron Beenri, withered and too old to be alive even for a drow, stood in the great chapel of Menzo Baranzon's first house, her house, watching the slow progress as her slave workers tried to extract the fallen stalactite from the roof of the dome-shaped structure. The place would soon be repaired, she knew. The rubble on the floor had already been cleared away, and the bloodstains of the dozen drow killed in the tragedy had long ago been scoured clean. But the pain of that moment, of Matron Beenri's supreme embarrassment in front of every important matron mother of Menzo Baranzon, in the very moment of the first matron mother's pinnacle of power, lingered. The spear-like stalactite had cut into the roof, but it might as well have torn Matron Beenri's own heart. She had forged an alliance between the warlike houses of the drow city, a joining solidified by the promise of new glory when the drow army conquered Mithril Hall. New glory for the Spider Queen, new glory for Matron Beenri. shattered by the point of a stalactite, by the escape of that renegade Drizzt O'Urden. To Drizzt she had lost her eldest son, Dantrag, perhaps the finest weapons master in Menzo Berenzon. To Drizzt she had lost her daughter, wicked Vendez. And most painful of all to the old wretch, she had lost to Drizzt and his friends the alliance, the promise of greater glory. For when the matron mothers, the rulers of Menzo Berenzon and priestesses all, had watched the stalactite pierce the roof of this chapel, this most sacred place of Loth, at the time of high ritual, their confidence that the goddess had sanctioned both this alliance and the coming war had crumbled. They had left House Banry in a rush, back to their own houses, where they sealed their gates and tried to discern the will of Loth. Matron Banry's status had suffered greatly. Even with all that had happened, though, the first matron mother was confident she could restore the alliance. On a necklace around her neck, she kept a ring carved from the tooth of an ancient dwarven king, one Gandalug Battlehammer, patron of Clan Battlehammer, founder of Mithril Hall. Matron Banry owned Gandalug's spirit and could exact answers from it about the ways of the dwarven mines. Despite Drizzt's escape, the Dark Elves could go to Mithril Hall, could punish Drizzt and his friends. She could restore the alliance. But for some reason that Matron Banry did not understand, Loth, the Spider Queen herself, held her in check. The Yochlal, the handmaidens of Loth, had come to Banry and warned her to forego the alliance and instead focus her attention on her family to secure her house defenses. It was a demand no priestess of the Spider Queen would dare disobey. She heard the harsh clicking of hard boots on the floor behind her and the jingle of ample jewelry, and she didn't have to turn around to know that Jarl Axel had entered.
"You have done as I asked?" she questioned,
still looking at the continuing work on the domed ceiling.
"Greetings to you as well, First Matron Mother," the always sarcastic male replied.
That turned Banry to face him, and she scowled, as she and so many other of Menzo Berenzon's ruling females scowled when they looked at the mercenary. He was swaggering. There was no other word to describe him. The dark elves of Menzo Berenzon, particularly the lowly males, normally donned quiet, practical clothes— dark-hued robes adorned with spiders or webs, or plain black jerkins beneath supple chainmail armor, and almost always both male and female drow wore camouflaging puwafwis, dark cloaks that could hide them from the probing eyes of their many enemies. Not so with Jarl Axel. His head was shaven and always capped by an outrageous wide-brimmed hat feathering the gigantic plume of a diatrima bird. In lieu of a cloak or robe, he wore a shimmering cape that flickered through every color of the spectrum, both in light and under the scrutiny of heat-sensing eyes looking in the infrared range. His sleeveless vest was cut high to show the tight muscles of his stomach, and he carried an assortment of rings and necklaces, bracelets, even anklets that chimed gratingly, but only when the mercenary wanted them to. Like his boots, which had sounded so clearly on the hard chapel floor, the jewelry could be silenced completely. Matron Banry noted that the mercenary's customary eye patch was over his left eye this day, but what, if anything, that signified, she could not tell. For who knew what magic was in that patch, or in those jewels and those boots, or in the two wands he wore tucked under his belt and the fine sword he kept beside him? Half those items, even one of the wands, Matron Banry believed, were likely fakes, with little or no magical properties other than perhaps the ability to fall silent. Half of everything Jarl Axel did was a bluff, but half of it was devious and ultimately deadly. That was why the swaggering mercenary was so dangerous. That was why Matron Banry hated Jarl Axel so, and why she needed him so. He was the leader of Bregand Ierth, a network of spies, thieves, and killers, mostly rogue males made houseless when their families had been wiped out in one of the many inter-house wars. As mysterious as their dangerous leader, Bregan de Eyre's members were not known, but they were indeed very powerful as most of the city's established houses, and very effective.
"What have you learned?" Matron Beanry asked bluntly.
"It would take me centuries to spew it all," the cocky rogue replied.
Beanry's red glowing eyes narrowed, and Jarlaxle realized she was not in the mood for his flippancy. She was scared, he knew, and considering the catastrophe at the high ritual, rightly so.
"I find no conspiracy," the mercenary honestly admitted.
Matron Beanry's eyes widened, and she swayed back on her heels, surprised by the straightforward answer. She had enacted spells that would allow her to detect any outright lies the mercenary spoke, of course. And, of course, Jarlaxle would know that. Those spells never seemed to bother the crafty mercenary leader, who could dance around the perimeters of any question, never quite telling the truth, but never overtly lying. This time, though, he had answered bluntly and right to the heart of the obvious question, and as far as Matron Beanry could tell, he was telling the truth. Beanry could not accept it. Perhaps her spell was not functioning as intended. Perhaps Loth had indeed abandoned her for her failure, and was thus deceiving her now concerning Jarlaxle's sincerity.
"Matron Mes Barris Armgo," Jarlaxle went on, referring to the matron mother of Barrison del Armgo, the city's second house, "remains loyal to you and to your cause, despite the—" he fished around for the correct word. "The disturbance," he said at length. "To the high ritual. Matron Mes Barris is even ordering her garrison to keep on the ready, in case the march to Mithril Hall is resumed. And they are more than eager to go, I can assure you, especially with—"
The mercenary paused and sighed with mock sadness, and Matron Beanry understood his reasoning. Logically, Mes Barris would be eager to go to Mithril Hall, for with Dantrag Beanry dead, her own weapons master, mighty Yutha Gentol, was indisputably the greatest in the city. If Yutha Gentol could get to the rogue Doerden, what glories House Barris and Del Armgo might know. Yet that very logic, and Jarlaxle's apparently honest claim, flew in the face of Matron Beanry's fears. For without the assistance of Barris and Del Armgo, no combination of houses in Menzo Berenzon could threaten House Beanry.
"The minor shuffling among your surviving children has commenced, of course," Jarlaxle went on. "But they have had little contact. And if any of them plan to move against you, it will be without the aid of Triel, who has been kept busy in the academy since the escape of the rogue."
Matron Beanry did well to hide her relief at that statement. If Triel, the most powerful of her daughters, and certainly the one most in Loth's favor, was not planning to rise against her, a coup from within seemed unlikely.
"It is expected that you will soon name Bergignon as weapons master, and Gromp will not oppose," Jarlaxle remarked.
Matron Beanry nodded her agreement. Gromp was her elder boy, and as archmage of Menzo Berenzon, he held more power than any male in the city. Except for, perhaps, sly Jarlaxle. Gromp would not disapprove of Bergignon as weapons master of House Beanry. The ranking of Beanry's daughters seemed secure as well, she had to admit. Triel was in place as mistress mother of Eric Tynaleth in the academy, and though those remaining in the house might squabble over the duties and powers left vacant by the loss of Vendes, it didn't seem likely to concern her. Matron Beanry looked back to the spike Drizzt and his companions had put through the ceiling, and was not satisfied. In cruel and merciless Menzo Berenzon, satisfaction, and the smugness that inevitably accompanied it, too often led to an untimely demise.
Chapter 2 The Gutbuster Brigade.
"We're thinking we'll need the thing?"
Catty Bree asked as she and Drizzt made their way along the lower levels of Mithril Hall. They moved along a corridor that opened wide to their left, into the great tiered cavern housing the famed dwarven undercity. Drizzt paused and regarded her, then went to the left, drawing Catty Bree behind him. He stepped through the opening, emerging on the second tier up from the huge cavern's floor. The place was bustling, with dwarves running every which way, shouting to be heard over the continual hum of great pumping bellows and the determined ring of hammer on mithril. This was the heart of Mithril Hall, a huge open cavern cut into gigantic steps on both its east and west walls, so that the whole place resembled an inverted pyramid. The widest floor area was the lowest level, between the gigantic steps, housing the huge furnaces. Strong dwarves pulled carts laden with ore along prescribed routes, while others worked the many levers of the intricate ovens, and still others tugged smaller carts of finished metals up to the tiers. There the various craftsmen pounded the ore into useful items. Normally a great variety of goods would be produced here. Fine silverware, gem-studded chalices, and ornate helmets, gorgeous but of little practical use. Now, though, with war hanging over their heads, the dwarves focused on weapons and true defensive armor. 20 feet to the side of Drizzt and Catty Bree, a dwarf so soot-covered that the color of his beard was not distinguishable, leaned another iron-shafted, mithril-tipped ballista bolt against the wall. The dwarf couldn't even reach the top of the 8-foot spear, but he regarded its barbed and many-edged tip and chuckled. No doubt he enjoyed a fantasy concerning its flight and little drow elves all standing in a row. On one of the arcing bridges spanning the tiers, perhaps 150 feet up from the two friends, a substantial argument broke out. Drizzt and Catty Bree could not make out the words above the general din, but they realized that it had to do with plans for dropping that bridge and most of the other bridges, forcing any invading dark elves along certain routes if they intended to reach the complex's higher levels. None of them, not Drizzt, Catty Bree, or any of Brunner's people, hoped it would ever come to that. The two friends exchanged knowing looks. Rarely in the long history of Mithril Hall had the Undercity seen this kind of excitement. It bordered on frenzy. 2,000 dwarves rushed around, shouting, pounding their hammers, or hauling loads that a mule wouldn't pull. All of this because they feared the drow were coming. Catty Bree understood then why Drizzt had detoured into this place, why he had insisted on finding the halfling Regis before going to Settlestone as Brunner had bade them. "Let's go find the sneaky one," she said to Drizzt, having to yell to be heard. Drizzt nodded and followed her back into the relative quiet of the dim corridors. They moved away from the Undercity then, toward the remote chambers where Brunner had told them they could find the halfling. Silently they moved along, and Drizzt was impressed with how quietly Catty Bree had learned to move. Like him, she wore a fine mesh armor suit of thin but incredibly strong mithril rings, custom fitted to her by Buster Bracer, the finest armorer in Mithril Hall. Catty Bree's armor did little to diminish the dwarf's reputation, for it was so perfectly crafted and supple that it bent with her movements as easily as a thick shirt. Like Drizzt's, Catty Bree's boots were thin and well-worn, but to the drow's sharp ears, few humans, even so attired, could move so silently. Drizzt subtly eyed her in the dim, flickering light of the widely spaced torches. He noted that she was stepping like a drow, the ball of her foot touching down first, instead of the more common human heel-toe method. Her time in the Underdark, chasing Drizzt to Menzo Berenzon, had served her well. The drow nodded his approval but made no comment. Catty Bree had already earned her pride points this day, he figured. No sense in puffing up her ego any more. The corridors were empty and growing increasingly dark. Drizzt did not miss this point. He even let his vision slip into the infrared spectrum, where the varying heat of objects showed him their general shapes. Human Catty Bree did not possess such underdark vision, of course, but around her head she wore a thin silver chain, set in its front with a green gemstone streaked by a single line of black, a cat's-eye agate. It had been given to her by Lady Illustrial herself, enchanted so that its wearer could see, even in the darkest, deepest tunnels, as though she were standing in an open field under a starry sky. The two friends had no trouble navigating in the darkness, but still they were not comfortable with it. Why weren't the torches burning, they each wondered. Both had their hands close to weapon hilts. Catti Bree wished she had brought Tolmeril